This week on Making Contact.
December 4th, 2011 is the 10th year anniversary of when the largest Muslim charity was shut down.
American Muslims are under the microscope, from Capitol Hill to your local shopping mall. With a constant stream of news about suspected terrorist plots, the effect on those communities living in fear of demonization or arrest has been devastating.
The only reason why they really got arrested was because we're Muslim and they had long beards. If you're going to arrest someone, do it for the right reason, not for something stupid like they did with our case.
On this edition, 10 years since 9/11, and 10 years of America's homeland war on Muslims and Arabs. Racial profiling has happened in times of war before. How will it end this time around? I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
I really just want you to picture this. A 57-year-old man with a closely cropped beard doing a headstand. It's a stretch he found in his book, Pilates for Men. He stands, and the world is right side up again, only he's behind a plexiglass wall. So at that point, prison guards burst into the room. "What are you doing, Mr. Alashi?" they say. "I'm teaching them," he says. "I'm teaching them." Of course, I'm talking about my father. And it was at this moment that it all came back to me. The arrests, the trials, the visitations, at that moment of basic humiliation. I hadn't seen my father in a year and a half. And when I finally saw him and he was demonstrating Pilates in front of us, a group of men burst into the room asking him what he was doing, demanding that he stop.
That was Noor Alashi, the daughter of Ghassan Alashi, who is currently serving a 65-year prison sentence for funneling money to the Palestinian group Hamas. Noor Alashi was more than one of a dozen people who spoke at a town hall meeting in New York City in December 2010, all people who believe their friends and family members have been wrongly accused, arrested, prosecuted, and often imprisoned because of their Muslim religion or their South Asian ancestry. Ghassan Alashi's case, known as the Holy Land Five, is one of the most well-known of these cases, but it's far from the only one. Throughout today's program, we'll hear many of those voices and others from a similar hearing in San Francisco.
In 2005, my son was arrested for the martial arts case. He's now doing 15 years in a federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. There were absolutely no weapons involved in Tariq's case. However, he was not going to get a fair trial, so therefore he wound up taking a plea deal.
Main drum ki member hoon, Desi Rising Up and Moving.
My name is Shahina Parveen Siraj. I'm a member of Drum, Desi Rising Up and Moving, and I'm the mother of Shahawar Mateen Siraj.
9/11 ke baad, America mein Muslimon ke
liye. Since 9/11, the environment for Muslims in America has not been good. In our mosques and communities, the government sends paid and undercover agents who, instead of catching wrongdoers, chase after our youth by entrapping them with lies and fabricated cases. And in this way, an NYPD agent who was paid a lot of money worked to entrap my son.
Is NYPD ki banayi hui saazish ki buniyad par Mateen ko 30 saal ki 30 years ki.
Mateen was sentenced 30 years in prison, even though my son did not even undertake any acts and was just based on words. He was denied true justice. Currently, he is in prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, where they have created a special prison known as Communications Management Unit, which is mainly intended for Muslims.
Jahan par musalmanon ko ke liye ek jail banaya gaya hai, jisko CMU kehte hain.
At the time, my son was 19 years old and not very bright or mature. In all these cases, these always go after certain kinds of vulnerable people they can easily entrap. These agents first use stories, websites, pictures of torture, and taunts in order to incite and provoke their targets and turn around and blame them and arrest them.
August 2004, Republican National Convention.
Just like my son's case was brought out just days before the 2004 Republican National Convention. Similarly, many of these cases are brought out at such opportune moments, like before elections or Congress votes on the war budgets. Always seemingly coincidental, isn't it? As in this country's history, the people from the countries against whom war is being waged have been targeted here at home as well. The purpose of all these cases is to keep Americans fearful of Muslims and immigrants.
My brother Tariq Mahanna, like myself, he was born here in the States, graduated from pharmacy school, both of us. And Tariq always had a passion for helping people. And in particular, even before he was taken, Muslim political prisoners really kind of occupied the core of that passion. In 2008, after some extended period of harassment, the FBI told my brother, they basically told him, we want you to be on our side because, we know that the community knows you quite well and you're trusted and, the community, you're in good standing with the Muslim community. So, we kind of want you to side with us in the event that we were to accuse somebody of something that they didn't do. And naturally, my brother, he has strong principles and he refused. And he repeatedly refused despite pressures by my parents to tell him to succumb. The FBI told him, well, if you don't help us, then we're gonna make your life a living hell. According to my brother, that's verbatim, that's what they said. In the end, they charged him with a bogus false statement to an FBI agent charge in 2008. The FBI, I guess, gets bitter when you refuse to cooperate with them. And my brother's currently, he's been in isolated confinement since October of 2009.
I am Shirin from Atlanta. Shifa Sadiq is mother. Our government targeted him because my son has the ability to teach about Islam through his writings, translation works, and speech, but they could not charge him for this. So they manufactured a case to keep him in prison. They kidnapped Shifa, a born American citizen from Bangladesh, when he was 19, a few days after his wedding in April 2006, and kept him in a secret location for days before he was rendered to the US. He was tortured in solitary confinement for over 3 years and physically assaulted before his case went to trial in the summer of 2009. The prosecutors claimed my son and his friend were going to do jihad and needed to be stopped. The lead US attorney in Atlanta was promoted to be the Georgia Supreme Court judge within 24 hours of my son's conviction. As you can see, there is a nefarious politics in place against Muslims in this country, and many people are profiting from this. This is our country, yet we are being oppressed simply because of our faith. My life has been disrupted and now filled with depression and tears. It is very painful for me to visit my son through a window where I cannot touch or hug him.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and we've been hearing some voices from a December 2010 event about preemptive prosecution. It's just one of the strategies being employed by law enforcement over the last 10 years that's resulted in the targeting of Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians. Joining us now for some perspective is Vina Dubal, staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we've seen so many of these cases where people are arrested, supposedly to prevent them from committing a crime. Usually the government busts what they call a cell, or sometimes a single person they call a lone wolf. But the evidence often turns out to be highly questionable or secret. Have these types of cases decreased the further away we get from 9/11? And has the Obama administration taken a different tack than that of President Bush?
Yeah, so I think that when it comes to preemptive prosecutions, I think since September 11th, we've seen a huge rise in these types of cases. Interestingly, a lot of people are being charged under Criminal Code 1001, which was signed into law under President Bill Clinton in the 90s and actually makes it a federal crime for someone to affirmatively lie to a federal agent on something that is relevant to an investigation. So, for example, if I'm, you know, say a material witness to a crime and the FBI comes to interview me and they ask me when I traveled to Pakistan. And I said, you know, I think I traveled back in September 2010. And really, I had gone in October of 2010. But that my travel dates were material to their investigation, I just lied to an FBI agent, which can get me many, many years in jail. So a lot of the people who are being preemptively prosecuted are being prosecuted under this type of law, people being charged with both lying to federal agents and with, you know, intending to commit acts of terrorism where the intent is highly suspect, especially when it's the FBI that's actually provided all of the weapons, provided the idea, the genesis of the potential act of terrorism, etc. And this has caused a real troubling sort of snowball effect in the community. People who otherwise might have, you know, wanted to talk to the FBI, who, if they had information about any kind of terrorist activity, might have wanted to go to talk to the FBI, are now scared to do so because of the kind of robust interviews you see happening in the community. You know, everyone is being interviewed. And so what we keep trying to say to the DOJ and to the FBI is, look, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You think that you're trying to stop terrorism by talking to everyone you can possibly talk to and gain information on everyone that you could possibly gain information on. But what you're doing is you're scaring a community whose trust you really need. And unfortunately, we don't think that they're hearing us say that.
Vina Dubal is a staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. We'll talk more with her later on in the show. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. In March of 2011, the post-September 11th tide of Islamophobia officially hit the halls of Congress when New York Representative Peter King held the first of three hearings in the House Committee on Homeland Security. The topic? The extent of radicalization in the American Muslim community and that community's response.
Today, we must be fully aware that homegrown radicalization is part of Al-Qaeda's strategy to continue attacking the United States. Al-Qaeda is actively targeting the American Muslim community for recruitment. Today's hearing will address this dangerous trend.
In the weeks beforehand, numerous individuals, groups, and other members of Congress objected to the hearings, calling them racist and raising comparisons to the McCarthy communist witch hunt hearings of the 1950s. But Representative King was not deterred.
These hearings must go forward, and they will. To back down would be a craven surrender to political correctness and an abdication of what I believe to be the main responsibility of this committee, to protect America from a terrorist attack. The Department of Homeland Security and this committee were formed in response to the Al-Qaeda attacks of September 11th. There is no equivalency of threat between Al-Qaeda and neo-Nazis, environmental extremists, or other isolated madmen. Only Al-Qaeda and its Islamist affiliates in this country are part of an international threat to our nation. Indeed, by the Justice Department's own record, not one terror-related case in the last 2 years involved neo-Nazis, environmental extremists, militias, or anti-war groups.
That focus by the federal government has come with costs, both financial and human. According to a 9-month-long investigation by Political Research Associates, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security spent more than $1.6 billion on counterterrorism training in 2010. And those trainings, often conducted by private firms, frequently reinforce negative stereotypes of Muslims and Islam. The report found that some particular frames were promoted. that Islam is a terrorist religion, that mainstream American Muslims have terrorist ties, they want to replace the Constitution with Sharia law, and are subverting the U.S. from within. Those notions about who American Muslims are trickle down to all levels of law enforcement, right down to your local police. In the city of San Francisco, that became painfully clear in March of 2010 when former police chief George Gascon was quoted as saying the city's Hall of Justice is susceptible to members of the city's Middle Eastern community parking a van in front of it and blowing it up. Community outrage forced the chief to apologize soon after, and a few months later, the city's Human Rights Commission held a hearing to understand the scope of the problem.
I also am of Iranian heritage, and noticing that some of the emphasis that had been placed by recent comments by SFPD for a number of reasons.
As you'll hear from many speakers this evening, Arab, Middle Eastern, South Asian, and Muslim communities feel under siege because of the law enforcement surveillance that they're experiencing from the FBI.
One time I became so frustrated that I took out this card. This is a Department of Veterans Affairs cards that U.S. military veterans get. And I earned this by serving 4.5 years in the Air Force. And I was on the verge of just throwing this at the officer and telling him to just take this because it doesn't mean anything as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't mean anything to not have a criminal record, to have served your country, to have sacrificed, to struggle both with yourselves and others to try to make yourself a better citizen, a more responsible citizen. And just because you're a Muslim, you're exposed to this humiliation.
They arranged another meeting with me at the same Starbucks. I told them at that time that I didn't want to be an informant for the FBI. And they told me that if I did not agree, that they would prevent my son from getting his green card. Now, years later, my son is still waiting for his green card.
When I grow up, I want to be a cop. I think cops are cool and make everybody safe. I do not like the cops at the airport. I've been on a plane more than 10 times since I was 4 years old. There is no beeping sound when I walk through the special door, but every time the cop stops me and puts me in a glass cage.
The one time I have not been checked was in Texas last year. I walked through the metal detector. An African-American gentleman, 6 feet, 6 inches, 300 pounds, gave me a hug saying, "I am sorry. I do not believe we are doing this to you people. I know our policy is wrong. I apologize for everybody." I do not want my kids to grow up in a country where they're pulled aside for the way they look. This is not the American way. I think we can make it better.
Based on that testimony, San Francisco's Human Rights Commission adopted recommendations to end racial and religious profiling of local Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian communities, which they hope will become policy for the city and the local police. That type of community organizing, demanding policy change from government agencies, is what's taking place all over the country. Back at the New York Town Hall, featuring family members of accused terrorists, those gathered called on each other to be brave, put themselves out in the spotlight, and put a new face on a community that has become demonized among much of the American public.
There are too many of these cases that are the same. It's almost like a pre-written script that they have, and we're all involved in it. If we don't fight together and really fight for our rights and for the rights of the Muslims that are really being entrapped in all of this coercion and lying and putting in jail for absolutely no reason, tearing families apart, fathers away from their children, husbands away from their wives, things will never get better. So I am really here for my son, but I'm here for a lot of other sons, also for a lot of daughters.
People need to see the face, the human face, that this is a human tragedy, what's going on. The families are being torn apart, the communities are being torn apart, and they have to be made aware, they have to see it. Too many people depend on the TV and they get 15 and 30 second blurbs across the TV like we were watching earlier tonight in the lobby, CNN, showing an old tape over and over again. I mean, that's all they're showing, and people see this. So they need to see the real people. They need to see you out there. Your representatives have to see you. I know some people are afraid. When I spoke at the Long Island Islamic Center earlier this year, some people came after me and said, well, we're afraid. You know, we're afraid something might happen to us. And I know that's there, but we have to get over it. You have to take that chance. It's not going to change.
I know my family and I are very disappointed in this country. I mean, it's not like we didn't realize these things happened before, but after this, I think my family's quite eager to leave this country. But at the same time, I think that it would be a disservice to the people who haven't, you know, been able to save their loved ones from the system. I think that if we really want to make a change, then we need to aggressively push for our Muslim communities to get behind us. And if we can do that, then we'll start seeing some things getting better. I mean, this isn't the first time this has happened in U.S. history. You know, like if you look at the Japanese during World War II, they got it pretty bad. I mean, sometimes I ask myself whether the same thing is going to happen to the Muslimin, you know, because the Japanese, for those of you who don't know, they were forcefully moved into prison camps, all the ones on the West Coast. You know, who knows if it'll get to that point with the Muslimin or not.
Could the current targeting of Muslims and Arabs rise to the level of internment as it did during World War II, when more than 100,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans living in the Western U.S. were rounded up and forced to live in camps? Let's listen to an excerpt from Of Civil Rights and Wrongs, the Fred Korematsu story, a movie about that era, and consider the similarities to what's taking place today.
General DeWitt was lieutenant general, about as high as they get, was the general in charge of the West Coast. There was some feeling that the West Coast might be invaded. He had recommended that the Japanese Americans be excluded from the West Coast so that they couldn't give secret tips to the invaders if the invaders ever came. That was sheer baloney because there's no instance ever discovered in which any Japanese American on the West Coast ever did anything disloyal. It was pure foolishness.
Colonel Ben Detson, who was a government lawyer, wrote all of the arguments for the internment that General DeWitt presented to the War Department. Ben Detson, who was a lawyer trained at Stanford and who should have known something about the Constitution, simply said that because Japanese Americans belong to an enemy race, their internment could be justified.
You see, before the war, my parents were very proud people. They always talked about Japan, you know, and also about the samurais and stuff like that. And right after Pearl Harbor, everything just, you know, they were just real quiet. They kept it to themselves. They were afraid to talk about that.
We had to have a bonfire in our backyard and burn everything that resembled Japan, even if it was a picture of your uncle in Japan in a Japanese clothes. My mother burned everything. And even calendars, anything written in Japanese made you a suspect.
The Secret Service and the FBI had swept into the Japanese American community and had arrested any community leader, any teacher, any civic organization head of any importance in that community.
I thought the exclusion order would be only for aliens, those that were born in Japan. I didn't think that the government would go as far as to include American citizens.
If you have the Western Defense Command, who was in charge of our movement, if they come at you with a bayonet in your back and say you're going to move into a horse stall, you do.
That was a clip from Of Civil Rights and Wrongs, the Fred Korematsu story. Now we're back in the Making Contact studios with Vina Dubal, attorney with the Asian Law Caucus. Vina, as the years go by, there are fewer and fewer people alive who even remember the Japanese internment, where the U.S. government targeted people based solely on their race or country of origin. Is there a danger of us collectively forgetting what took place then? And do you think it's valid to compare that time with what's happening to South Asians these days?
Certainly, members of our community, the South Asian Arab and Muslim community, have learned many lessons from how the Japanese Americans responded to internment. You know, many of us have gone to law school. Many of us, as a result of what we saw happen after September 11th, have become very politically active, civically engaged, and have tried to organize our communities. I've heard this comparison made between Japanese internment and the post-9/11 situation of South Asian Arab and Muslim civil rights abuses often made in the sense that we've called what's happened to these communities a type of virtual internment, where people are afraid to think anything that might get them in trouble. They are afraid to say anything that might get them in trouble. They are constantly afraid of law enforcement. There is a burgeoning literature around this, not just an academic literature, but people have written many, many nonfiction books about the experience of young men and women after September 11th being detained, disappearing, being sent to Guantanamo Bay, being questioned by the FBI, being preemptively prosecuted, etc. And certainly it's affected the psyche of a new generation in a way that has really inculcated a feeling of not belonging in this country, especially for people who are second, third, fourth, fifth generation, people who, you know, call America home, who don't feel at home abroad and don't feel at home here either, a real sense of an identity, a split identity or a lack of identity or a lack of a place that really holds your identity. This isn't just someone's civil right that's being violated, but these are lives that are being threatened. This is the very fabric of our nation that's being threatened. It's the quality of life for everyone in this country that's being threatened by this culture of hate.
Hello, everyone. My name is Layla Duca, and I'm the daughter of Tritan Duca and the niece of Shane and Elvier Duca. I am here today to talk on behalf of my father and uncle's case. Their case is called the Fort Dix Five. Now, I know some of you guys have heard it before, but some of you guys who haven't, I'll explain it. It all started out with two informants. Their names were Mahmoud Omar and Besneek Bakali. The informants kept pushing the Dukas, Schnoor, and Tatar to say something stupid so they could get caught by the FBI. In the summer, all of the guys went to the Poconos, and they invited the two informants. And during that vacation, the informants recorded every single conversation they had, and they also recorded it on tape. During the vacation, all the guys went paintball shooting, horseback riding, and gun shooting for fun, not for practice. But the informants made it seem like it was for practice. I'm sure all of you guys heard a specific word on the news and everything. That word was Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar doesn't mean anything bad. It means God is great. Now, I'm sure that like when people go to church or something, they'll say God is great or amen. That means the same thing. If they can say, why can't we say it? Isn't it a free country around here? If you look through all the recordings, you will hear Bakali trying to push the Dukas into agreeing to kill the American soldiers. Then you would hear all of them saying, what are you talking about? We aren't going to do that. Because in Islam, there's no right to kill innocent people that haven't done anything to us. After the informants tried pushing all the defendants, like a couple weeks later, they got arrested. At first, we didn't know why, but like after a couple weeks later, we knew that none of those reasons they got arrested for was true. The only reason why they really got arrested was because we're Muslim and they had long beards. If you're going to arrest someone, do it for the right reason, not for something stupid like they did with our case. Sometimes I have to cry myself to sleep, thinking about how my family was torn apart. These people are ruining our lives. That's why I came here today. I came to put a stop to this. And this didn't happen to only our case. It happened to everyone else's case that were Muslim. We have to come together as a group and fight for our rights. Thank you.
That's right.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Jessel Noor. To hear an extended length interview with Vina Dubal, or for the full length recording of a December 2010 town hall about preemptive prosecution, featuring many of the voices you heard on today's show, log on to our website, radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.